Good afternoon, everyone. You're supposed to respond. Good afternoon, everyone. Come on. You better be alert. It's my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker, Jamie Dimon. Jamie has an undergraduate degree in psychology and economics, and then went to Harvard Business School for an MBA. He worked, as many of you probably know, with Sandy Weill at American Express and a few other organizations after that, all the way to Citigroup. But then Jamie and Sandy parted company in 1998. What does Jamie do? He takes a year off, and he decided he was going to read a lot, and he also took up boxing. When you think about that, that's terrific experience for sparring with the regulators. He was appointed CEO of Bank One Corporation in Chicago in March of 2000. That was an organization, as many of you know, from the Midwest, was made up of Bank One, First Chicago, and NBD in Detroit. That very same year, J.P. Morgan and Chase Manhattan merged. It was an interesting year, 2000. Bank One then merged with J.P.M. Chase in 2004 when Jamie became president. He then became CEO in 2005 and chairman in 2006, and he led the organization through what we all know what happened in 2008. He's completed 10 years as chairman, president, and CEO with record results in 2015. And Chase today is the largest U.S. banking organization, which is the result of major banking consolidations that really started back in the late 1980s. Jamie's famous for his bus tours around the country to visit employees and to visit operations, including one here in Naples a number of years ago where he was chastised because we only had one branch. We now have quite a few facilities in town, so I expect you to thank him for that. Jamie is also noted for renting an RV and taking his three daughters on trips out west and other parts of the country without mom. And he may have to comment on that, but I think that was a unique experience. I didn't think he had a pliers and a screwdriver either. But Jamie, we're delighted to have you here. Please join us. Jamie Dimon, Chairman, President, and CEO. J.P.M. Chase.
Thank you. Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here. I know it's been a while since that trip. I've been to Naples many times. I haven't been back to this club, and so it is a pleasure. Vern did always complain that we had one branch here, and now we have 15. Vern and a wealth management unit, and so I'm going to have, you know, I'm fortunate in my job. I love my job. I'm going to tell you a little bit later, but I do get to travel around the whole world and get to see what's going on in China and Japan and Europe and the United States. And what I'm going to do is take you for a little tour around that world. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about, I think, what's going on in the economy today. But before I do that, the most important thing about the United States of America, and this is the most important, is we have the best hand ever dealt of any country right now. There's this fiction out there, then you hear from some of the politicians, that somehow this country's in dire straits. We have some serious issues that I'm going to talk about at the end, but the fact is, if you look at what really makes a country great, okay, this country has it all. I'm going to start with the best military the world's ever seen, and if you've served the military, thank you for that. And it will continue to be the best military for decades. We also have the best military barriers ever built, called the Atlantic and the Pacific. We also have peaceful neighbors, Mexico and Canada. And I point that out because when I go to China, I want you to think about this fact. They are surrounded by the Philippines, Japan, Korea, Pakistan, India, Russia, Mongolia. It's a tough part of the world, folks. And they've had plenty of wars with those neighbors. We also have the United States has all the food, water, and energy it needs, and China doesn't. And I say it respectfully. If you were running China, you have to have in the back of your mind, you know, to keep your people healthy and fed and stuff like that. And here are the other things we have. We have the best rule of law of just about any country you go to. When I got out of business school, we were talking about Japan. It was taking over the whole world in 1982. And then was the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And then it was MIST, Mexico, Indonesia, South Korea, and Turkey. We have the best rule of law, other than, by the way, as it applies to banks. The way banks get treated is just not under the rule of law anymore. We have an unbelievable work ethic. And that's still true. And you know, you heard these kids standing up here. Well, we have that. We have the best innovation the world's ever seen. And I'm not talking about just Steve Jobs. I'm talking about large to small. You go to a factory floor in the United States or walk into one of our branches and you ask a teller, what could the company do better? And they'll answer that question. Remember, a lot of innovation comes in large and small. It's not always large. And so, and we have it everywhere. We have it in almost every business and every science. We've got it in turbines and healthcare, you name it. Obviously, semiconductor, Silicon Valley, et cetera. We have the widest and deepest capital markets the world's ever seen. I'm talking about the markets in total, not just banks. I'm talking about venture capital, private equity, individual investors, open markets, public markets, private markets. It's pretty unbelievable. And it does not exist anywhere else in the world like this. And it obviously is part of an important thing that drives an economy going forward. and so this country is unbelievable. And you know, when you travel around the world and you come back, you know, it just stares at you like how difficult it must be in some of these other countries who've perfected bureaucracy. They don't have any innovation. We've got the best businesses in the world, small, medium, and large. And all three segments are vital to the growth of the economy, not just one, which I think is a mistake you hear out of Washington all the time. They're all vital. The top 2,000 companies do about 50% of all capital expenditures. So it is critical to this country. And capital expenditures, at the end of the day, drive growth and productivity. That one thing. So always keep your eye on that one thing that drives growth and productivity. So this country, we kind of have this blessing. We do have these issues, which I think is serious, by the way. I don't think they're life-threatening yet. Okay, I'm going to mention five of them, and I hope that one day our political system actually deals with them. Number one is immigration. We have an immigration policy, and it's terrible, it's unfair, it's immoral, and it's bad economics. You know, I don't know if you all know this, we educate tons of kids from overseas in the best universities in the world here, and they can't stay here and have a job. People are having jobs overseas in engineering, science, technology, math, and physics because we can't hire them here because they're immigrants. And I vaguely remember immigration is kind of what made this country great. Infrastructure, it's an amazing thing that we don't have better infrastructure planning. You know, and you go to Singapore, Hong Kong, it's kind of embarrassing when you fly back to JFK. And you would think that we can plan infrastructure, you know, but every city, every state, and the federal government, and that we should have a plan, and actually it would also be good economics because you could actually accelerate that plan if you have a recession, but you're not building bridges to nowhere. You're building bridges and tunnels and roads and hospitals and airports you actually need. Our fiscal situation is not terrible yet. Our debt to GDP is like 70%. It went way up in the Great Recession. But if you look down the road, okay, and I don't think it's going to affect the economy in the next 10 years, that debt to GDP will start going way up. Okay, and the entitlement program is going to start to cripple every other program there is. And we have to fix it. And honestly, the sooner we do it, the better. And I'm hoping our politicians get around to that. Our inner-city school education, you know, one of the great hopes of this country is these kids. And I gather 16 high schools in Naples, and you kids were amazing. And what you're doing and what you're accomplishing and what you're doing both in the community field and school and your ambitions and keep it up, that is the hope of America. The problem isn't Naples. The problem is in a lot of inner cities, it's mostly inner cities, half the kids don't graduate high school. They don't have the skills to get a job. Even the kids who graduate don't necessarily have the skills to get a job. And among that group, there may be a Steve Jobs or an Albert Einstein, and we'll never know. And worse than that, it creates lack of opportunity. The one thing this country stood for was opportunity, and we're not giving it to a big part of our population. And I think it creates very bad politics, which you're seeing today. So the country has these serious issues. If there are serious people focusing on them, I think we can get them fixed. In the short run, the United States is actually doing okay. And I urge people, separate the market. The market's got a lot of fear from economic facts. And facts are things like people working. Okay, there are 143 million people working or so. Okay, it's 12 million more than were working in 2009. Wages are going up. The household balance sheet of the average American is in better shape than it's been in 30 years. 30 years. Okay, home sales are going up. Homes are in short supply. Household formation is going up. wages are going up. Car sales are at all-time high. And companies are in great shape. If you look at companies, look at their balance sheets and their capabilities are in great shape. Credit is in great shape. So the actual facts on the ground are okay. Meanwhile, I have all this noise. And this noise is legitimate noise, and it's market fear. But markets, as I have to point out, are often wrong. They haven't always been right. You know, someone once said markets have predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. And the fears you have today, you know, is China. It's the reversal of QE, and I'll talk about these in a little more detail. It's the reversal of QE. I guess politics in America, when you travel around the world, okay, what I get from people, I was just in Davos, and Vern asked me if the field of the business council in Davos. People are nervous, and they're nervous about the things I'm talking about here. But the biggest thing about Davos, which I should remind you all, is when you go there, it's, someone said it's where billionaires tell millionaires what the middle class is feeling. And so... So the fear is China, the reversal of QE, the political situation. The one thing that I did notice out of Davos, remember Davos has always been wrong when it comes to China, always been wrong. They're wrong in 07, they're wrong in 08, they're wrong in 09. So I look at this common knowledge as sometimes whatever Davos says, I kind of think we should be doing the opposite. And there is fear there. But what is palpable to me is a lack of American leadership in both global economic policy and global foreign policy. And you hear it everywhere. So 5 years ago in Davos, you know, we were still the ugly Americans who caused the crisis, some of which is true. And you know, now it's like, where are you guys? We miss you. And there's no one who can provide leadership like America does. It is impossible. The void will be filled by lots of different interests, and only America filled that void, not in its own self-interest, but in trying to keep peace around the world and commerce around the world, et cetera. And, so there are these things that people concern, oil and gas. You know, oil and gas going down from 100 to 30 is a pretty dramatic move. It's happened, by the way, 5 times since I've been working. Okay, so it's not that dramatic. In fact, commodity prices was cotton, corn, oil, chicken, soybeans, wheat, corn, you name it. They've all moved 50, 60%. Commodity prices move in very little supply-demand imbalances, and so do interest rates, which is a commodity if you think about money for a second. But oil going down so much, obviously it's hurt the oil industry. Remember, it's also hurt oil exporters, Brazil, Russia, Saudi Arabia. It's helped Japan, India, South Korea. It helped China. China's a huge importer of oil. It helped the American consumer. The American consumer today has $1,000 more of cash in their pocket than they had 2 years ago because of gas. And we think they're spending it. So you hear this, you know, they're spending it. We think they are. Savings are going up. Wages are going up. They're also spending the gas money. But one of the issues about the oil thing is that, obviously, the oil companies are spending a lot less in capital expenditures. The way the people who receive the money, so the money just moved from one table over here to another table, but you're maybe eating out and traveling and buying a car, you were doing deep capital expenditures. So it has kind of changed a little bit, the flow of funds and around the world. Saudi Arabia selling assets, Norway selling assets, et cetera. So these issues are real. I'm not sure they're going to derail the American economy. And China, here's my view of China. Okay, China is, if you serve on a bank risk committee, okay, and, you know, we were in India about a year ago, and we're talking about making more investments in India and serving companies in India, and the media had gone on and on and on, and people started talking about how bureaucratic it is, how corrupt it is, how road it is, how it's very difficult to do business there, and we shouldn't do it. And I said, if you were sitting in London in 1860 at Junius Morgan and Company, which was J.P. Morgan's father, and he was sending his son J.P. Morgan over to America to help industrialize it, to send capital there, you would have had the conversation about America, and you would have said, it's corrupt, it's dirty, there are gangs in the street, it's about to have a civil war, has enormous racial problems, and this democracy thing hasn't yet been proven. And you would not have made those investments. So my view on China is that they have made enormous progress. I mean, enormous progress. They were a nation of 1 billion poor people in 1950. Okay, they are now a nation of like 1.3 billion, of which 500 or 600 million are still poor. They live in little rural areas. But the rest are almost entering the world is we would all know. And if you go to the major cities, you'll see that world. And they've had 20 years of 10% growth, which the world has never seen, ever. Not even the United States, which is the greatest economy the world's ever seen, ever had anything like that. It was far more volatile than that. And now they've hit a bump in the road. My view has always been is that they're going to hit a bump in the road. It was much easier when they macro-managed the economy and they could say to you, build the bridge over there and build the hospital over there and you You built a plant to make bottles, and you know there was no bridge to nowhere. There was no wasted capital because they needed all those things, and the country could macro-manage it. They have to make two huge transitions. One is to a, I'm going to say, a broader democracy. It won't look like ours, but they have to broaden it out. There is no developed nation on the planet that doesn't have some kind of broadened out democracy. Zero. None. Okay? And the second is a broadened economy. I think of it as a market economy, but what that really means is that businesses and individuals making lots of little decisions, micro decisions, where that plan is going to be, you know, where we're going to do this, where we're going to invest our money, that's what's going to drive the economy one day. It can't be top down. And to do that, you read about in the paper all the time, their convertibility, their currency, they don't have capital markets like anything we have. They don't have venture capital, they don't have really private equity, they don't have a lot of businesses that are, their biggest companies are owned by the state, and the problem with that is corruption, bad investment, low returns, wasted money, and they have to fix that. And by the way, they know that. They are quite bright. They're very most of them have been educated here. They look at America and they say, what an unbelievable place. You guys don't fully understand how great you have it. And I think they're going to get there. I think it's just not going to be smooth anymore. So you're going to have these moments of fear and panic where they look out of control. What they did recently in the stock market, in their currency market, I would just call it ham-handed. You know, they were trying to manipulate it, and that doesn't actually really work. But just about every government's tried it at least one time in their life. And the likely outcome is in 30 years, they will house 35% of the Fortune 5,000. That's the likely outcome. And that's what J.P. Morgan is building to. And a little bit later, I'm going to tell you how J.P. Morgan tries to invest in the United States and around the world, and that they're going to have a rocky road in the meantime. They have $3 trillion of essentially unencumbered money. A lot of it is actually held in dollars, like in U.S. Treasuries, and they have the ability and the capability to fix their problems. So they're going to, one day, you know, they'll have zero growth, but right now, we think they're going to accomplish their lower growth. Getting out of QE is nerve-wracking. We don't really know. It's an experiment. It's never really been done before. So you have to be thinking about it. You have to be worried about it. Though my guess is the United States will do that without dire consequences. So J.P. Morgan, you know, I'm here, and, you know, Vern, I have two predecessors here, Vern and Dick Thomas. Where's Dick? Dick is right there. And a former director over there, John Hall, who was always fabulous with me. And, you know, so J.P. Morgan Chase, it's actually 3,000 companies today. Because you may remember Chemical, Manny Haney, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Guaranty Trust, Bank One, First Chicago, National Bank of Detroit, Texas Commerce Banks. There were five major Texas banks. Three went bankrupt in the 82 oil crisis, and five went bankrupt, and three are part of us today. WaMu, Bear Stearns, and God knows, John B. McCoy's sisters here. Bank One bought 500 companies. WaMu bought 300 companies. And I am just so damn proud of my company. I think it's one of the great companies on the planet. I don't buy all this stuff about big bad banks and all that. There were some big bad ones, by the way. Of course, we all make mistakes, but this company, we operate in 100 countries around the world. Okay, we move $6 trillion a day. We serve 50 million American households. Okay, we serve 6,000 corporations around the world, and we do a lot of things that can't be done by small banks. We are the largest bank to small banks. In fact, I'm thinking about doing an op-ed letter about that. So if you talk about community banks and small banks, we're their partner. We help them move money. We finance their mortgages. We buy securities from them. We do M&A for them. We do bond deals for them. So I'm, you know, and we want, in this economy of ours, we need large, medium, and small. So think of a small restaurant to a big chain. Well, we serve the big chains too. So we serve people like Caterpillar in 30 or 40 countries around the world who need cash, securities, FX, derivatives, swaps, capital, et cetera. And we can raise bonds for people. We can raise bonds in three different currencies, in three different time zones, $10 billion in a day for people. And that's what, you know, that's what some of these big companies need sometimes. And so we support some of the biggest companies in the world. So I'm really just proud of this company. I do get to, and I, of course I stand on the shoulders who came before me. All of these folks work so hard to put together these companies in very tough times, by the way. And I feel fortunate to stand here as kind of a, I call this an end game winner. We're here, we're stable, we're strong. We went through the crisis. We did not need TARP money, okay? And we actually bought Bear Stearns because the federal government asked us to, and it's now cost us another $5 or $10 billion. We bought WaMu, and the government was begging me to. I wanted to do that one. It's now cost another $5 or $10 billion. We're steadfast. One of the things I think about banks have to be there for clients in good times and bad times. Banks cannot be the kind of person, we're not like the stock market. You know, the markets themselves are a little bit amoral. If people get scared, they won't buy bonds. They sell. Like in the last global financial crisis, you couldn't move securities. You couldn't raise money. But banks were there. They were actually rolling over the revolvers. And they weren't asking for exorbitant prices. They said, no, you've been a client for 20 years. You know, we're not going to hold you, hold your feet to the fire and quadruple the price, which is what the market did. So banks have to be there, and banks have to be steadfast wherever they are. So where all the countries operated in, when I go to those countries, they want us there. I always make a joke. I travel around the world. I meet presidents and prime ministers, sovereign wealth funds, central banks, regulators. They all want more of us. They want our people, our capital, our brains, our intelligence. I said, there's only one city I go to that doesn't want me there. Washington, D.C. And it treats me like we're bad. And but those countries want to know, just like a business wants to know, just like a consumer wants to know, we're there in good times and bad times. We're not going to up and run. We're not going to panic. We're not going to, which means, by the way, we bear risk, like quite a bit of risk sometimes. So like in the oil patch today, I was in Dallas last week. I'm going to Houston in a couple of weeks. The clients, now some of them are desperate. We're going to try to work with every one of them. We may very well lose quite a bit of money. But my point of view is when I go back to Houston in 5 years, I hope they say, you guys were great when the times were toughest. I hope they remember that because that's just an absolute critical thing for them to do. So I'm proud of the company. We continue to build it. And, I tell people, we have people who 20 million people now bank on the phone. You can move money, deposit checks, et cetera. And if you're a corporate treasurer, you can move money in this device too. You can buy FX, and in, I think about a month ago, they'll do interest rate swaps. So we're always using technology to serve people better, faster, quicker. I think we'll always have branches, by the way, because I think people need that for documentation, for advice, et cetera. So we're going to keep on building. The way we look at the economy I just told you about in China, the United States, is keep my eye on the ball, which is no matter what happens. So if China, the likely outcome is that they'll do quite well. There's a small chance it'll be terrible. I don't know. I can sit here and guess all day long. But I would tell you, if you're a shareholder, if it's terrible, we're still okay. I'll just be sitting here and explaining to you why we're having a really, really bad quarter or maybe a bad half of a year. But that's it. That's all we're going to bet. We're not going to bet the house on anything. So my view is take a long-term view, open your branches, train your people, build your systems, support people, and then manage the risk, which we do very, very carefully because obviously we have huge amounts of risk that we do around the world and in the United States. And to keep on building, and hopefully someone else will one day be running the company. They'll take it to another level. So Vern, I think I'm going to stop there. Are you ready? Okay. Thank you. Okay. You want me to use this now? Okay. We'll answer them quickly, Vern. Oh, my God.
Well, there are several here about the election. First is, why don't you run for president?
If I was here about a year ago and you said that, I would have said, there's no way a rather wealthy, brash New Yorker could ever be elected president. And my second answer is, I have too many skeletons in the closet. No, but my real answer is a lot of these people have been running their whole lives. I think it's not a rational thing because you're a CEO, and even if people think you're a good CEO, that Nestle translates to Washington. Washington is a very tough place, and most people who become president, they ran multiple times. Barack Obama, didn't, but he was kind of running since he got out of college, in my opinion. And so, Donald Trump, I think this is his third run, and most of the people on stage have been, in politics their whole lives. So I think you need to be in politics, you need to be in the party. If you want to have a chance.
And there are about half a dozen questions here. What do you think about the current front runners, particularly Trump?
Yeah. So I'm going to be a little circumspect here, but I'm very surprised. I don't think he's got the background for it or the knowledge. I'm surprised that he could be rude like he is and that it does, for some reason, he can do it. And hell, if I did it, my board would probably have to fire me. I didn't expect him to survive this long. I've been told, by the way, that he didn't expect to survive this long. and that he's now, but now he has a chance, and now he can actually be the Republican nominee, and which means, by the way, he's got the higher staff. He's going to have to start to have to take policy positions. He's going to have to disclose his taxes and all these things that he has not had to do yet. So we'll see how that goes. And then Hillary, I hope, and you never know, well, I hope she'd be a decent president. And I'm not talking about whether you're Democrat or Republican. I'm just talking about, will someone be serious, have serious advisors, take serious advice, be very thoughtful about things, try to fix some of the serious problems I spoke about. I'm hoping that Trump would do that too. I just, it seems hard to imagine, but and this country's survived a lot. I should have said, by the way, that our political system, as much as aggravated as we might find it today, you don't question that we're a democracy. So remember, when I just gave that list of countries around the world, Brazil, Russia, India, China, Mexico, Indonesia, South Korea, Turkey, some of them started as democracies and they're going the other way. So that's not our problem. We just don't like the current politics, but we're to blame.
Here's a question from a student. What is the it factor to become a CEO or president of any organization?
Well, was that from one of the kids here? Yeah. You know, it's really important. There is no one factor. So one of the things when people say, like, you know, what's the three important things, the five or the six or the three plus and the three minus, forget all that. What are the really important things? And so work ethic, you can't replace it. You know, I add work smart. I know a lot of people, they waste so much time. I'm sure you guys all did. I did when I was your age. And you know, I'm just very efficient in my work. I read fast. I keep a very good list. You're smart enough to be CEOs and presidents, believe it or not. The question often is EQ, like your ability to relate to people. Do you earn people's trust? Do you earn their respect? Can you get things done? Are you organized? Are you thoughtful? Do people want to work for you? I mean, it's an amazing amount of people who are very talented, but most of us, there's no way we'd go work for them. And so do you earn people's trust and respect? Do you treat people properly? So it's really a whole bucket of stuff. And the other thing I'd say is a lot of people think you have to crawl your way to the top. You'd be surprised you get pushed to the top. People like to be in a company when someone gets promoted, they'll say, that's a great choice, as opposed to, oh God, you know, that was so-and-so's crony and their buddy and you know, someone who they say kisses up and kicks down. You know, they treat people really well above them, but they treat people below them terribly. My advice to you is treat everyone fair and proper. Everyone. So if you're a JP Morgan and you're a senior executive and I saw you not treat the mail room person or the receptionist or a secretary badly, I tell you exactly what I think of that. And so, you know, to me, all those factors will determine your success, not any one of them. Oh, and stay, your whole life you're going to be learning. And you all know this in the room. It's not like you go to school and you learn and you stop. Whatever you do the rest of your life, be a doctor, a lawyer, in business, in any kind of profession, it doesn't stop. So always learn. There are only two ways you can learn. One is by reading. One is not by osmosis, by putting the book next to your head, but it's talking to other people. So if I wanted to know, you guys said you're studying some science and stuff like that, I would know a lot more about some of the things you do if I spoke to you than if I read a whole book about it. And so I learn a lot just by calling people up and just rat-a-tat. I got a million questions, I want quick answers, and then you learn a lot that way. You know, get out in the road. So I'll tell you, are you going to ask about a bus trip later, or should I describe that?
Oh, let's talk about the bus trip.
So you got to get on the road. Whatever business you're in, if you sit in your quarters, you know, you could be dominated by people down the hallway, other executives. That should never happen. Okay, everyone should be allowed to walk in the office. You should always. So I do these bus trips. I do road trips. This is a Gulfstream aircraft trip. but literally, the bus trip, we put on jeans and polo shirts. I get some other executives with me, and we've done it in Florida, California, Midwest. I go to call centers, sometimes for barbecues, town halls, kind of like this, or private sessions. I meet with small business clients, private clients, middle market clients, large corporate clients. Like we had one in Palm Beach, and an invitation at Jimmy Lee's house, who unfortunately passed away. It was mostly retired CEOs. And it said, you know, jeans, welcome, something like that. I even sent Jimmy Lee a pair of jeans because I knew he didn't have any. And I'm the only one who showed up in jeans. Everyone else was in a suit and, you know, and stuff like that. But on the bus, in between branches and openings and operating centers, we have people from the operating centers, from the branches, tellers, branch managers. And we do what we call, we give them a beer and immunity when they get on the bus. Tell us whatever you want. What's really terrible? What doesn't work? What do the competitors do better? And we learn, we literally take a list, you know, literally 200-300 things, fix some we fix on the spot. We call into the place, say, you're going to add three people there, you're going to do this. Some we have to do a little bit of work to figure it out. And we all do it to learn more from your clients, your customers, your branches, your own people. And it's a lot of fun. And it's a great use of time, even though most executives would tell you, I'm too busy to take a week to do that. It's the most productive week you'll ever do.
He did that here in Naples. He invited a bunch of us. He said, business casual. And he and his troops show up in jeans. So yeah.
I think it was one of the first trips that people didn't meet. I kept on saying, I'm going to be in jeans. Tell the clients I'm going to be in jeans. I didn't want to insult anyone. But the people couldn't believe I was going to do that. So they just kept on saying business casual. Yeah. And I finally said, no, business casual does not mean jeans. You know. And
another question. What are your thoughts with high levels of student debt and what can be done about it?
Well, I'm of several minds here. First of all, people are responsible when they borrow money. So this argument that somehow the government took over student debt, they took it over about six, seven years
That's
ago.
Right.
It was half that it is today. It's doubled since then. When they took it over, I told them it was going to be a disaster. It's a train wreck coming. Okay, and like our fiscal thing, like Detroit, you could see these train wrecks 20 years forward. Now, if you divide, it's $1.3 trillion. The mortgage market's like $9 trillion, so it's not huge. But it's become too big a burden. What the government did is they don't really look at your credit, your ability to repay, which the banks were doing, the student lending programs. And also because of the Great Recession, the government let you go to multiple schools. And the government, now, of course, what's going to happen is the government won't make you pay it back. Because that's the government. They're going to come with a million programs. They already come with multiple programs. Why people don't have to pay it back? Well, if you continue to go to school, you don't. No more than 10% of your income. We'll give you a six-month deferral. So we should fix it. We should stop doing bad credit. We should fix some of the credit. By the way, it's not the $1.3 trillion that's the problem. If you look deep into it, it's probably about $300 or $400 billion. The rest of it's probably fine. And the $300 or $400 billion is kids who've been going to school for 6 or 7 years. They have far too much debt. They can never repay it. Or certain types of schools. What I should also say about inner city school education is really important. We have a solution to this. It's called community schools. If you go to Germany and some parts of the United States, these schools are teaching kids skills that when they get out, they have a job. And that's the point. And so our government says community college should be free. Make it free. Well, I'm in favor of doing great stuff. If you make it free, you'll get more of it. And it isn't what you need is a community degree. What you need is a job when you get out. And that's got to be done with business and the school locally. So if you go to New York, there's a school called the Aviation School. Kids graduate high school, $60,000 jobs. Because they learn how to work on airplanes. And you can do it for robotics, coding, accounting, healthcare, a whole bunch of healthcare skills. And, you know, so we know what to do. It's got to be done locally, by the way. It can't be done. So if you did it here, you got to work with the local businesses here to figure out what certificate, and the business should be involved in the training. So that's their people there. So their own people will say, no, these kids are ready to work in our company. So lots of things that can be done.
Actually, in the early days, when the banks were making the loans, they usually got parent guarantees.
Yeah.
The government didn't ask for that. Here's another student question you stated.
But if a bank tries to collect on a parent guarantee, they usually get sued.
Right.
I didn't know I was
so we were glad the government took it over?
Yeah.
No.
No, we stopped doing any student lending the second that happened. No more.
Another question from a student. Yeah. You stated in 1950 China was just a country of poor people. Knowing how successful China has become today, despite its challenges that you mentioned, do you also see it possible for all nations to eventually become developed?
Yeah. If you look at the world, I think there's like 200-plus countries in the world. And the world's been developing at a different pace. So if you look at most of Europe, at least in Western Europe, it's fairly developed. You know, Northern Mexico is doing great, by the way. So, yeah, the world is slowly lifting itself up. There's been no 20-year period where it didn't get a lot better than it was before. And 2 billion people lifted out of poverty from capitalism. I mean, so you can look at the flaws of the system, but you also look at the positives of the system. And so country by country, if you did a study of countries, and this is kind of amazing to me, you won't see more of this, there are all these countries that have done unbelievably well. So forget America for a second. But the ones who you may have said had no reason to, after the Korean War, Korea. South Korea has done unbelievably well. North Korea hasn't. Take West Germany and East Germany. And this is where they go back to, they call it a zero-sum game. Like, you're rich because, you know, I'm poor because you're rich type of thing. East Germany and West Germany, side by side, in the exact same position after the war, like destroyed, but the same education systems, the same side by side, 1946. West Germany is a major power. East Germany absolutely collapsed in the Soviet system. That's what happened. And by Argentina, Venezuela, Ecuador, I go around the world. How does Singapore? Singapore had South Korea no oil, Singapore no oil, no water, three different cultures, Malay, Indian, and Chinese. Wealthiest nation on the planet today. They developed themselves. Education, systems, infrastructure, planning. And so it's doable. Good policy. If you have good government and good policy, it is completely doable. And the converse is corruption, communism, all these things are just destroyed. I mean, if you look at Cuba, I mean, the Castros destroyed Cuba. They hurt their own people in the name of good. And my guess is that the people who run the place live really well, like the 1% here. That's just another way of distributing to the 1%.
This is an editorial comment. Can you address the fallacy that TARP funds were not handouts?
Yeah. Well, here's the reality. At the time, when I was called down, and I think it was October 9th, Hank Paulson called me up and said, I need you to come down this Monday. It was a holiday. I said, Hank, I'm not coming. It's the first weekend I haven't worked in 6 months. You got to come. It's really important. Said, okay. I fly down, and you walk in the room. There's Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke and Sheila Bair and Tim Geithner. And then on the bank, on the other side of all the banks, and we all know each other, of course, so we're talking and laughing and making jokes. But they say, we want you all to take TARP. Okay, they had thought about it. We hadn't. We want you to take TARP. And $25 billion for J.P. Morgan, you know, $10 billion for this one. We know you all don't need it, but we think this can help the American economy from getting much worse. It'll create confidence in the banks. It was obvious at the time they couldn't give it to just half the banks. If you had woken up in the morning, it was a subterfuge, folks. If you woke up in the morning and they announced that these five banks were taking TARP and these five weren't, what would you do with your money? There would be a run in those banks. And so they couldn't do that. And they said, if we get U9 to take it, we can get 1,000 of others to take it and take the capital issue off the table, and that maybe banks will be more aggressive and people will be more relaxed. And part of that worked, by the way. No one realized it would be a scarlet letter. No one. And, you know, I called my board. A couple of CEOs said, I'll take it. I said, aren't you going to talk to your board? Nope. I'll take the money. You know, I called my board, and I explained to them the circumstances, and we all agreed it was asymmetrically bad for us, that we didn't need it. You know, and we probably were saving some. And I do think it saved some banks, by the way. And that wouldn't have been good for us either, but it saved some banks. And we thought we were doing a favor for the country. And we made a PR error, by the way, a small one, walking out. Hank Paulson asked us not to talk to the press. By then, there were all the cameras and TVs. So all of us walked out, and we waved off the press like this, you know, like people do. And the next morning, headline says, kind of like, not only did they take the money, they were ungrateful.
A couple of questions here about Dodd-Frank.
But the other thing, what saved the system wasn't TARP. It was the wall of liquidity the Fed put up. That didn't save J.P. Morgan. That saved every company in America. Anyone had short-term financing. And that's what it did. And I think they did the right thing. I give full credit to President Obama and Bush and Geithner and in hindsight, you can say how you might have done it differently or better. At the time, no one had any idea. So they did the good old American thing. They came out punching. They kept on trying. They didn't give up. And eventually, they stopped it from what looked like might have been like the Great Depression. So I do give them credit. You know, since then, it's just been very tough. I mean, banks have been discredited, and it's very unfortunate because it's not good for America, in my opinion.
That leads on into a couple of questions with regard to Dodd-Frank. Should it be repealed? What's your take on political threats to break up the big banks, et cetera?
So the other thing I should mention about TARP, too. So the storyline was they were bailed out, they caused the problem, and they paid themselves a lot of money. And that's still the storyline. And part of that's a little true. Some of the banks did cause the problem, not all of them. Some were bailed out, not all of them. Remember, the government caused the problem, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. It hit tons of industries before it hit banks and stuff like that. They bailed out General Motors, and you don't hear much about some of those things. But I do think there's this issue that the American public didn't feel like there was Old Testament justice. There should have been CEOs who didn't take their $50 million. It was outrageous. I was outraged at the time, by the way, that some of these people virtually destroyed their companies and walked away with all this kind of money. And so, you know, certain things they put in Dodd-Frank, like clawbacks, I think is actually good. You know, I think if a bank goes bankrupt, they should fire the board, fire the management, claw back a lot of comp, and people should know that everyone's going to get punished a little bit. And because what we did, I understand what the damage it caused. And Dodd-Frank is thousands of different things. So when you say to Dodd-Frank to me, we have thousands of requirements, reporting requirements. Some are important. Some made the system better. So capital liquidity makes the system better. Transparency makes it better. There's some more of that. Having boards more engaged makes it better. There are tons of things which are just bureaucratic, slow, complex. You know, we're spending $3 billion more a year on AML compliance. We have to do it. Some is better. Some is just bureaucracy. And so, you know, it's killing the smaller banks. I'm very sympathetic to small community banks. They're just getting killed by this. And it's just unfair. You know, we can afford it. You know, we make almost $40 billion pre-tax a year. So if I spent $3 billion doing that, that's fine. So if it were up to me, I wouldn't repeal it. I would modify it. And, you know, in the old days when you had huge legislation like that, there was, oh, I forgot what they called, but it was always after the fact they went back and they opened it up again and fixed it. We haven't done that with Obamacare, and we haven't done that with Dodd-Frank. And it's stopping us from fixing the problems we have. And I think it would be easier to do that than try to rewrite the whole thing again. And, you know, too big to fail banks. So here's where I agree. A bank, we should be allowed to fail. I don't think there should be a concept that a business should get bailed out. Okay? The government should have some place where they can manage it so it doesn't hurt you. I agree with that concept. I think they kind of have that in Dodd-Frank. They had it before. Remember, you guys all remember Continental Illinois. They were able to take down a big bank, you know, unwind it in a way that didn't damage the American economy. And it should be paid for by banks. You may not know this, but if a bank fails and the FDIC has to pay, which it does, it's paid for by other banks. We've paid $10 billion to the FDIC in the last 6 or 7 years. $10 billion. Okay, so it isn't like, you know, so we're paying for the failure of a lot of banks at this point. And so I agree with those concepts. I think some of those things would be fixed. If someone says we should break them up because they're too big to fail, they're not looking at facts yet. If you look at all the facts, I don't think that's true. I think the problems have been mostly resolved, and we should finish it. If they're saying they're breaking up for economic reasons, well, that's not true either, because J.P. Morgan Chase, 5 of the last 6 years were record years. 5. Last year was a record. The year before that was a record. Our market shares are up in every business. We earn an adequate return on capital. It's been 15% on tangible equity, 15%, 50%, then 13. It's not great. But it's not like what's happening in some other businesses around the world. So, and our clients are happy. So I always say the most important thing to me isn't what I think of it. It's what you think of it. If you're walking in our branch and using our services, and most of you people, when they use them, they use 4, 5, or 6. And if you're a corporation, they use 20 or 30. You know, that's because they're happy. You all have choices. You're not coming to J.P. Morgan Chase because we make you. It's not a monopoly. It's a choice. And so we're earning client success, and that's the most important reason. The other thing I've also heard people talking about is that, you know, big banks don't innovate. That's just totally absurd. I mean, we do huge innovation. Okay, and I just mentioned we can do an iPhone today, but if you went to our trading floors, if you look at how we custody money, if you look how corporate treasury can access money around the world and consolidate and swap into FX, you'd be shocked. And it's virtually instantaneous and very cheap. So the cost of our service has actually been coming down for 50 years. And you may all remember when you used to buy and sell stocks, 25 cents a share. And you have to call, the order be called down, they call it down to the post, they call you back. You know, now it's, you know, pennies a share. It's instantaneous, and you can do it on here. You know, so these are huge benefits to consumers that, you know, people forget to think about.
I'm going to switch subjects briefly, because we have plenty of bank questions, but where do you stand on the Apple FBI controversy?
It's a big deal, okay? And I don't think the American public, I'm on both sides of this, so sometimes it's not either or. This is an important one. In fact, let me just make a side note about Democrats and Republicans. I wish that Democrats, when they talk about entitlements, would say, we want to take care of our sick, our poor, and our old, but we acknowledge the inefficiencies and abuse in the system, and we should go get that. I think Republicans should say, we want to take care of our sick, our poor, and our old. They should say it, but we want to do it efficiently and properly, not just as giveaways. So, and some, they should kind of bind it that way. So the Apple thing is, I don't think the American public understands how much data they have. Not just they, everyone's got on you. Like, I don't know, how many people, you use this thing, you push, I agree. Okay, well, we studied all those, what you agree to, on Google, Apple Pay, Mint, You agree to a lot of stuff I'm not sure you know. And your data is being used and being sold and being marketed. And you know, banks, by the way, have a huge amount of data, too. We can't sell our data by law to third parties. Okay? So we are very tight in protecting the data. So I think you were entitled as a citizen to real data protection. I do not think that Apple is entitled to decide when and how you get it. And so I think this has to go to Congress, and they should do it really thoughtfully about what is private or not. So I can get, you know, they needed to get in your house, they get a warrant to get in your house. They want to get in your car, they get a warrant to get in your car. If they want to get a warrant to get in your phone, they get a warrant to get in your phone. What Apple's saying is you're making me build the software to get into the phone. If I do that, then once that software's out, other people can use it, and you've made it bad. Well, it still needs a warrant. It still needs a warrant. So this is a tough debate, and I think it should be had really with really smart people thinking through the right way to do it.
Comments about Fed policy here, and what do you think about the possibility of negative interest rates?
So the QE policy, which is essentially the Fed buying treasuries, which creates deposits in the system, presumably that you'd have the cash do something else with it. It would lift up asset prices, and I think QE1 worked. I think QE2 worked less. I think QE3 worked even less than that. It's a little bit like pushing a string. You're not necessarily going to invest your money or build a plant or do something like, or you make a loan because there's more money, unless there's economic activity that actually drives stuff like that. So I give them credit for it. Now they stopped it. They basically essentially stopped it, and now they're starting to talk about raising rates. You might have seen this morning retail sales were pretty good. You know, the inflation index the Fed looks at was 1.8%, up from 1.4, so it's going in the right direction. If it goes to 2.4, you're all going to start getting worried about it. I think it's the right thing to slowly raise rates. To go back to what I call more normal, normal is a good thing. If the economy is growing and rates are going up, it's not, by 25 basis points means nothing to anybody. Zero. So it's not an economic thing like in the old days, you know, if you raise rates 100 basis points, you know, lending would get crunched. They're not raising it kind of that much, and it's never been done before, so we don't really know. It's an experiment. So we position our company, we're fine any which way. But the fact is, I think normalization is a good thing. I don't think America's got to do the same thing as everybody else. I think that's a misnomer. If these other countries are having tough times, they could be, you know, still doing QE, and we're doing the reverse. And yes, it'll affect currency prices. And I do not think you're going to see negative rates in this country. You know, it's become a big thing. You know, we're on the other side. Inflation is at 1.5% or 2%. Zero is not a normal thing. And where they have done negative rates, it hasn't seemed to work. So now you're getting factors saying, I'm not sure that that's the way to do it. You can do more QE without negative rates. So there are other things. It's not like they've run out of bullets like people, because there's plenty of what they could do. And it shouldn't be just monetary policy anymore. The central bank shouldn't be relying on to do all this stuff. There should be coordinated monetary and fiscal policy which would get us growing faster. I would say, by the way, when I talk about the strength of the country, that we're growing now like 2%, kind of broad-based, it's okay. I talked about what shape people are in. Why is it not faster? I can't prove this. I think big data will prove it one day. It's not faster because unbelievable regulations, somewhat Dodd-Frank, uncertainty, whether you're for Obamacare or against it, it created some uncertainty and hurt some small businesses. Bad policy, like, and I'm not blaming Democrats, Republicans in either of these things. It's just bad policy, including a government shutdown. And then we were, 2 weeks away from a government default? A default of the United States of America, the economic powerhouse of the world, which, you know, I think could have been catastrophic. And someone said to me, well, we don't think so. I said, yes, but I said it might be catastrophic. You're going to take a chance? What chance? 1%? 2%? I think there's a 1% or 2% chance it would put the world in a depression within 3 weeks. That's how bad I thought it could have been. I don't know, but I would never take that chance. And they were actually taking that chance. The whole thing was shocking to me.
We have one more question, but before that, I have to give you these two books for your collection.
Thank you.
Culture and History of Marco, and also about Naples, Florida. So great. Those are to take with. And the last question is, what keeps you up at night these days?
Well, you know, in reality, it's not, you know, if you're in my business, you know, you got to worry about markets and credit and economies around the world and stuff like that, and that's normal. But that doesn't really keep me up. The thing that actually keeps me up is this thing I said about bad policy, that we're shooting ourselves in the foot. We are causing damage. We are hurting the future generations. We're not educating them enough. That I wake up, it makes me sick. It actually does keep me up. We're attacking some of the best industries in the world that we have. We dominate global banking. We dominate aircraft. We dominate medical. We dominate pharma. We dominate. Do you want to give that up? Because we're killing these companies. And I'm worried about we're starting to eat our own in this country. And you see it in local politics and the anger out there. And so I'm hoping someone comes along and fixes it.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jamie.
Thank you. Folks, thank you all very much. Appreciate it.
Great job.
Great job.
You want to give those to you?
Yeah.